Hey, what's going on? It's Doug here. This is the Mile High Five podcast, of course, and I wanted to jump in before I send it to the episode. You might remember, if you're a longtime listener, you might remember that Carl quit the show, and it was very sad. We recorded a farewell episode and everything, and many folks emailed me. It was great to hear the support that I'm continuing on with the show. Everyone was sad that Carl was leaving, but good news, Carl actually recorded a few episodes with me at FinCon, and I'm pretty sure that he's going to record like once a quarter with me or something like that, whenever I could convince him. In fact, he was here like last weekend to record another episode. So he has some free time occasionally. You know, don't tell him that I let it out of the bag, but he has some free time and he does like recording. So anyway, this episode was recorded live at FinCon. And whenever the booth is open and they let people sign up, I always sign up because I don't know who I'm going to talk to, but I know that I could fill the seats. So I got the booth for four people. Carl was going to be with me, of course. So I was like, okay, we could get Jeremy Schneider from Nectarine. So we'll get him on, and our other friend, Chad Carson, he was going to hop on too. And interesting, while those guys have been going to events for several years, they hadn't met each other before. So it was kind of cool that they didn't meet each other until like a minute before we sat down to start recording. So it went well. And I think they had a nice time. They're good dudes. That's why we invited them. So we just kind of had a round table. We prepared just a little bit beforehand. And it was fun. It was fun to record. There's always like just great positive energy when you're in the expo and then people are walking around and they're waving at us and stuff like that. In fact, we had a little like a drive-by hello from Matt and Joel from How to Money. And I think we may leave in the interruption. I think I made it worse by, I was like, come on guys, come on over here and chat with us. So anyway, pretty fun to do that. And both of those guys have things that they're working on. So I won't try to rehash it now, but follow the links in the description and the show notes, and you could help support them if it's the thing that you're looking for. And I won't push it too hard now. Like I said, we talk about it in the episode, and I forgot what we said in there. So it's been like a month at this point. So anyway, those guys are on there. And I think the week that this is coming out, I think I have it scheduled for like Thanksgiving week. So you got the Black Friday deals going out there. I think most listeners, most viewers out there, you already know, you know, don't buy stuff you don't need. I've been known to, you know, catch the fever. You know, you get all these emails, you could save money. And I think I got this from my mom. I love a good deal. You know, if it's a good deal, if it's a good value, I'm thinking, well, I should take advantage of this, even if I don't necessarily need it. And I've gotten better over the years. I wait. I think if I really need the thing or not. And my wife is also a good filter. Sometimes I'll go to her and I'll say, I'm thinking of buying this thing. Can you just convince me that I don't need it or that I shouldn't buy it right now? And she's super effective. Elizabeth is really effective at keeping me from buying things that I don't need, which is great. Like if it's something I don't need, then I don't need it. So, all right, got a couple ads here that I need to let you know about. So number one, this is awesome. And I think if this applies to you, you need to like take action on this. I think there might actually be Black Friday deals, so it's a little bit of a better deal. So in the last year, I've saved $180 because I switched to Mint Mobile. And I used to be on one of those big cell phone companies. And basically, I knew that we were paying way more than we needed to. And I would call up and they would not give me any promo deals. They're like, you're on the lowest plan. We were on some corporate discount as well. But the thing is, you could switch to Mint Mobile and use that money that you have saved for, I don't know, you could buy Christmas presents for people. You can buy guitars. You know, that's one thing I may reallocate some of those funds. Or you could buy, like a weekend trip, something like that. If you want, whatever, you know what to do with money. You save it, you invest it, whatever you want to do. So here's the deal. New customers are eligible for any plan, any data plan for $15 per month for 3 months. So it'll be $45 when you sign up. But if you're like a huge consumer, you can get like the big plan. Now, Personally, my wife and I have the 5 gigabytes per month plan, and that's plenty enough for us. So it's $180 annually for each of us, and we pay on the annual deal, so we get a bigger discount. And previously, we were paying about $1,440 per year, so it was like $120 per month. So we're saving, I mean, a super... It was shocking. When we switched, it was shocking. So anyway, go check it out. Thanks to Mint for partnering with us on the deal here. And you can go to milehighfi.com/mint. This episode is also brought to you by Ghostbed. And I love our Ghostbed. We have the deluxe version, and it's a little bit softer than the classic version. That is what we prefer. I was able to actually go over to Carl's house and test out his classic. So that one's a little bit more firm. The thing is, Ghostbed, they have several different models. And you, if you don't know what you want, you could take the 3-minute sleep quiz to understand like which mattress should work best for you. And one of the greatest things about the Ghostbed, I think almost all of their mattresses, they have a cooling technology. So it's like a cool to the touch quilted cover. And I believe there's some special technology in the layering there that actually makes it feel a little bit cooler. And I run hot all the time. Even in the winter, I'm often really warm. And one of the toughest things is when we're on vacation and, you know, there's some sort of a hot foam mattress. I cannot stand it. I need the cool touch of a ghost bed. So do check it out. They have all sorts of different mattresses. Again, you can take that sleep quiz. They have the bed sets and other accessories, sheets, pillows, all that kind of stuff. We have a pillow too, one of the ghost bed pillows. And they have a 101 night at home sleep trial, full range of products. You can save 50% site wide if you use MileHighFi at checkout as your coupon code, or you can go to ghostbed.com/milehighfi, and we appreciate the support.
Hello world, welcome to the Mile High Fi podcast. Today we have Coach Carson and Jeremy Schneider joining us. You might hear some noise in the background because we're at the Expo Center here at FinCon.
And it's actually presented by the LLCattorney.com. And we appreciate them sponsoring the thing, and they told me to read that.
Cool. You did a great job.
Thanks. They're doing a great job. And it's Doug Cunnington here, by the way. Carl's been out of practice because I don't know if you guys knew this. He quit the show.
What? Yeah, I quit. But now I'm back, apparently, at least for temporarily.
Yeah. It's good to have you back, man.
Yeah, it's good to be back. What did I say? What did I mess up on the intro?
Well, you didn't say, here's my co-host, Doug.
Oh, man. Sorry.
That's all right. I'm here, probably. All right. And yeah, we're at FinCon. We're having a couple of drinks. And for the people that don't know you, Coach Carson, who are you? What do you do?
I live in Clemson, South Carolina. I've been investing in real estate for 21 years. We like to travel. That's kind of been our name of our game. My wife is a Spanish teacher, English teacher. We like to go abroad. And so we have a daughter, 11-year-old and a 13-year-old daughter. And a couple of times we lived in Spain for a year. We lived in Ecuador for 17 months. So we sort of have this mix of investing, real estate, rental properties, and then let's just take off and go do something and do a little mini retirement for a year and a half. And that's sort of, in summary, kind of the family and the lifestyle that we try to hold up.
Amazing. And Jeremy, how about you? What's your story?
Yeah, I'm Jeremy Schneider, and hi guys. I'm so pumped to be here. I teach personal finance and investing at Personal Finance Club. And my quick story is I retired when I was 36 after selling a company I started in college. And really had nothing to do after that. And then I started my passion project of teaching people about money and personal finance. I just really like it. Some people like skydiving or kite surfing or much more cool endeavors. And I like Roth IRAs and index funds.
I'm a real estate nerd. I'm right with you, man. Nice. This is fun.
And you guys don't know each other really, right?
We just met.
Yeah.
Great. So yeah, a little bold. A lot of times we'll try to get folks that know each other on, but we reserved the booth and we had an extra spot, and I was like, we'll just get them both in here and we'll talk. So the idea for today is kind of a round table. We really don't have a specific topic. We got a couple talking prompts to get us started, but that's what we're going to cover today, which is a little bit different. It'll be all over the place. We actually don't know where it's going to go, but Carl, do you want to kick her off?
Yeah. So there's one thing I find completely fascinating about both of you, and that's, I'll go with Coach Carson first. When you came out of school, you were debating between being a linebacker in the NFL, going to medical school, or being a real estate investor. I don't know if that's ever happened before in the history of Hubids. And Jeremy, you had your startup in college. So both of you came out of college. You never worked a normal job. You went straight into entrepreneurship. I'm curious about the mindset of that, because I don't think most people think like that. I know I certainly never even considered it. How about you, Jeremy?
You know, I had two internships in college at Microsoft, and so I had a taste of corporate America, and it was a great company. They paid well. You know, I have no complaints about them, but I just didn't like being a cog in the machine. And I think in a different lifetime, I might have like joined the Peace Corps on Teach for America or something, but I was dating someone who was still finishing college. And so I was like, well, I can't really leave town. I don't really want to work for a big company. So I just decided to start a company. And I literally, sometimes when I hear myself saying, oh, I started a company in college and I sold it for $5 million, I can imagine people being like, okay, that guy is like operating. He's like, he must know something I don't, or he must have gone like a little how to start company briefcase when he was 3 years old. And like, and that really wasn't the case. I literally had no idea what I was doing. I just, almost my naivety is what allowed me to do it. Cause I was just like, all right, well, I don't want a job, so I'll start a company. So I Googled how to start company. Like, well, I was really concerned about like, you have to fill out forms or something. Is the government going to like put me in jail if I'm, you know, not doing this right? And then just kind of day by day, just figured it out from that point forward. And it, you know, it was rough. You know, there's years where I was living on credit cards where I couldn't even make enough money to, you know, pay for the most meager of groceries before I finally started making more money and had more success. So definitely at the beginning, it wasn't like I knew this was going to work. It was just like, I'm naive and don't know what I'm getting into.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And Chad, what was your mindset?
Yeah, it's very similar, actually. The word being a cog in the wheel, I think, resonates with me. And for me, it was those three paths. I applied for medical schools. I'm really interested in biology to this day. I like science. I like biology. I tried out for the NFL, but they just rejected me. So that was easy. Mark that one off the list. I didn't know.
Yeah, I also did not make the NFL.
Yeah. But. So that was a kind of a dream, but not really. The thing for me though, I'm a pretty logical, rational person. I like to use spreadsheets. A lot of people in the FI community, I think, are. But for me, the fork in the road was like a very emotional decision, is that when I thought about going to medical school or working for another corporation, I thought back to my like real or my football experience of going to meetings and just like, you know, making me do stuff that I didn't want to do. And it was just very like lack of freedom was like the feeling I had. Whereas when I thought about being an entrepreneur, I didn't know if I'd succeed, but I felt excited. I was like, I have flexibility. I have freedom. Yes, there's risk. But as a 23-year-old at that point, there wasn't a lot of risk. I could, you know, I was willing to live in a tent. I had a Toyota Camry I owned free and clear. And I felt at that point in my life, the downside was like not very high, but the upside was complete flexibility, freedom. It just felt really exciting. And that's sort of the path I just went with, the excitement, with the enthusiasm. And that was the right thing for me. And to this day, that's kind of a good, even though I like to use spreadsheets and all that, the navigating by excitement and what's fun is a pretty good compass for me.
I have one follow-up. Both of you said you didn't want to be cogs in the wheel. You didn't want to work for Microsoft. Neither of you wanted a 9-to-5. I kind of felt like, I'll back up a second, neither of you probably knew it at the time, but I think that quality is what leads us to financial independence. You all just did it early. Like Doug and I got fed up with our jobs and eventually left. We found this whole FIRE stuff. But you realized that whether you knew it or not, when you were like 18 years old, which is pretty cool, you bypassed the whole corporate America bullshit, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, I think maybe that is just part of my personality, that I just don't like, you know, the big corporate overlords. I don't like, you know, being told what to do. And I mean, I think maybe everyone feels that way to some degree. And I just had maybe the opportunity to do it at a young age. But yeah, I didn't really even know what FIRE was until I basically was FIRE. I learned that, you know, I got to a point where I was like, oh wait, I think my investments are growing faster than I'm spending at this point. And so maybe I can retire. And then when I started getting into this community, I learned more, oh, this has a name and there's other people that are doing this. And yeah, so I kind of like backed into it. But I wish I'd known more about it, because I think it's a really nice goal to strive towards. And be like, oh, okay, you don't need to be in the rat race until you're 65. You can, you know, there's other paths.
I think the one thing to say about being an entrepreneur first, it sounds kind of sexy, but I think it's easier financially to go get a regular job and save money. I think the probability of success of FI is easier doing what you guys did, because there's the steadiness of a salary. I mean, I think back to some of the risk I took. I mean, there's a couple forks in the road with real estate investing. We hit 2007, 8, and 9, and, you know, you have leverage in real estate, and you know, if you run out of cash, you're in trouble. I mean, there's some same with business when you're starting a business. The successes are really good, but the failure, there's a bunch of failures. Yeah. And so I don't feel like my path was as probable as if I would have gone another route. But so I think anybody who thinks about going the entrepreneur route needs to know that. But I think that's where I think the excitement comes in. If you're not excited about starting a business, if you're not, if the freedom, if like being, you know, cooped up in a corporate culture doesn't like squash you and you just have to do, you don't feel like you have to do this, I don't think it's for everybody. I think it's okay, but it's not a 100% thing for most people.
And how old are you guys, if I may ask?
44.
43.
I'm 45.
I turned 44 in 2 weeks. All right, 45? Oh, yeah. We're almost the same age.
And yeah, how old are you, Carl?
No comment. Okay. 50. I'm 50 years young because that's what old people say.
Distinguished. You got that full head of hair, though. It looks good. So the thing is, you guys reached FI. Like, Chad, would you say you're at a point where you're FI?
Yeah. My 30s, mid-30s is kind of where I think, for sure.
And so both of you hit a point where you don't need to work anymore, yet you're still doing some stuff. Like, you're working on another startup, which we'll talk a little bit about. But why are you? Where are you going back for more? What's going on? Why are you starting another thing? And then we'll go over to you, Chad, after that.
When I was, I think I always had the dream of retiring early. I didn't just know there was this thing called FIRE and, you know, 2-4% rules and things like that. And I just envisioned myself having every day be a Saturday and traveling and playing video games or, you know, whatever it is. And I did that. I quit my job at 36 and for a year and a half or so, I did nothing. I traveled, I coached beach volleyball in Italy. I went to Australia for 2 months. I, you know, tried to be a bodybuilder, you know, worked out, like, you know, just whatever. You're like, if I had all day, what would I do? And I did. And what I found is like it lacked, you know, you still have to live your life, right? And it was like, it was fun for sure, but it wasn't really purposeful. It wasn't really meaningful. I felt like I lacked tension in my life, where it's just like, I could just wake up every day and watch Netflix all day. And so I felt, and I also like, I get a lot of value from building things when I'm working on a project. So I didn't intend to, you know, go get a job or even to start a company. I wanted to build something. So I started a passion project of just creating an Instagram account where I was going to teach personal finance, and that kind of snowballed from there. But I think the net is that I'm doing exactly what I want to do. You know, I don't have to be working for a paycheck now, but I think real FIRE is like doing whatever you want to do. And for me, it's building things. So I like doing that.
Got it.
I found that my journey is very similar, but it's looking back, the arc of my life and my career has been more in seasons. So it's like you go through a work season, and then I go, our mutual friend, Jillian Johns, who talks about mini retirements. Mm-hmm. You know, you take these little 6 months, 1 year. For me, like, I do want to have that time when I'm doing nothing, or for me, doing something totally impractical. Like, I learned Spanish while we lived in Spain, and, you know, I learned to do other things. I wrote a book, and I didn't know where it was going to go. Like, I like to have these periods of my life where I'm kind of taking, instead of waiting to your wait later in life to do these travel and these things, do those interspersed throughout your life. But then the main part of for me at least, is being useful, doing something practical, building something. And I'm not a good builder with my hands. That's not my thing, but I love storytelling, I love ideas. And so for me, making a podcast, teaching, like, I feel almost called to be a teacher. And so just after a reflection, I'm like, okay, I could do anything I want. I don't need the money. What do I want to do? And I wanted to teach people. And I also have a nonprofit locally. Now, this is a whole other segue we can go on, but I got really frustrated by local, like, alternative transportation. There's lack of walking, biking in my community. So just as an entrepreneur, there's just this impulse that we have of solving problems. And I got frustrated by that. But to solve this problem, it wasn't a business solution. It was more of a, we need to start a movement in our community. We need to start a nonprofit. So I really enjoy that idea of taking, there's a seed of an idea, there's a problem. How can I organize and build something around that? Whether it's a business, whether it's a nonprofit, whether it's a, you know, communication channel, like a podcast, to solve some problem. Like, I want to do that the rest of my life. I never want to retire from that.
Okay. Yeah, can you expand about the nonprofit a little bit more?
Yeah, it's called the Friends of the Green Crescent Trail. So there was 9 years ago, I was pushing my daughter in a stroller when she was young, and I was trying to go to the local park a quarter mile away, and there's no sidewalk, there's no good crosswalk. I was like, what is going on with this? And we're almost getting hit by trucks. And so I went to local community like planning meetings, and everybody agreed, like, yeah, our town's really great, but we have no connectivity. I'm like, was anybody working on this? And the city planner's like, no, not really. So I'm like, all right, that means I got to do this. And there was one student group who had named, they had this map of an idea called the Green Crescent Trail. And I live in Clemson University, is this, the main employer there, but these little towns around, they had this idea to connect all the local towns by walking and biking trails. There's a big forest in our area with beautiful waterfalls. So there's this idea of connecting all that. And that, so we took that vision and then we just started building on that. And it's been the slowest slog I've ever been in my life. It's been, we raised $3 or $4 million, $3.5 million, damn, I think. We built a couple miles of trail, but it's not like, most of those trails are like rail trails out there. People have heard of those where you take an old railway and turn it into a trail, but we don't have any railways. So we're having to go acquire easements from churches and the State Department of Transportation. We're trying to get easements on the side of the road. And it's been this, like, I had no clue about any of this stuff, but now I'm like fanatical about studying urban design and how to, why is transportation the way it is? And why do we build for cars and not for people? So I've gone down this rabbit hole of learning. It's been fascinating, but the end result is we have a bigger community now supporting this idea of an alternative transportation network. We have a website, we have a nonprofit, we've raised money, and slowly but surely local governments are supporting it, but they just move really slowly. It's just like the pace of government is very frustrating.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Jeremy, you said something a moment ago that I think is quite important and I'd like you to elaborate on. You said your life lacked tension. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. I think when people become adults, money becomes a primary tension in everyone's life. And I think collectively as a society, we kind of all buy into this idea that money is our problem and money is the solution. You know, if I had more money, if you can't pay the light bill, money is definitely a problem, right? If the lights are getting shut off because you can't pay for utilities, that's a huge problem, and getting more will solve that. But there's this assumption that that continues. Like, okay, if I can pay the light bill, I'm good. Then if I can get a nicer house, I'm even better. If I can get a better car, I'm better. If I can go on a vacation, I'm better. And so there's this constant tension, and that I think almost gives us this innate purpose. If we work hard, we can work against that tension, get more money, get more success, like win at life. And I had this weird experience where I went from making $36,000 a year as a bootstrap startup founder, almost nothing, to being a multimillionaire with the click of a refresh button on my bank account. And suddenly the tension went away, you know, because I didn't, you know, my net after, you know, when I retired, I had about $3 million. And that's, you could definitely burn through $3 million. But I was living like I was making $36,000. And so just, I had such an extreme change. I think a lot of people are more like the frog in the boiling water, where it's like getting slowly hotter and they don't notice that they keep ratcheting up their quality of life and keep spending more. And so that tension went away from me and I was like, oh, I don't need to make more money to, you know, now what? And it left me with an empty feeling. I'm like, okay, if I'm not just trying to win the money game, then what am I about? What am I doing? And that's why I think I felt kind of like lost after, you know, in my year of doing nothing. That's why I wanted to introduce some tension, because I felt better as a human when I was actually building something and working towards something. I think that gives us purpose, you know, for whatever. It's kind of ephemeral, like what are we as humans? But like, you know, it's not, I think, someone just meant to sit on a couch and watch Netflix all day, because that's not a very good feeling after, you know, three days of it.
Yeah. Well, what kind of tension do you have in your life, Carl?
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that a little bit later when we get to some of these other things. But I think that's very important, because a lot of people call five people out. Oh, you're retired, but you have this blog, or you're doing this, you're doing X, Y, Z. And I can't imagine a life more boring. I'll back up a second. I injured my foot jumping off a table at Oktoberfest. And all I had to do, the doctor's like, you should just sit there and try not to walk. And I usually walk 25,000 steps a day. And that drove me batshit crazy sitting around. So I think the most horrible thing would be to sit around and not do any work. And now work can mean many different things, but I think that's the key to life. Like I think Mr. Money Mustache would define it as voluntary discomfort, whether that's exercise or a job, a new challenge with Nectarine or whatever y'all are doing. We need that in our life to be really happy. Chad?
I love this tension idea. And I was going to push back on the people who say, because it is a common objection I get to when we talk about financial independence, is like, why do you do all this sacrifice or all this work to have financial independence early when you're just going to be working anyway? And what I want to say is, like, the people who I've heard that from, 99 out of 100, haven't tried having a bunch of money first and then reintroduce intention into your life, because it's so, I don't know what you think, but it's so much different. I mean, it's on a whole nother level of create for me. It's creative. It's amazing. It's like, what do you want to do when you grow up? When you've got a pile of money, when you've built this net worth, it's not that you have to live off that the rest of your life. It's that now I have FU money. Like, I can do whatever I want to do. And that's pretty cool. Like that. And so for me, like, I'm still podcasting. I'm doing other stuff, but I'm also doing this Green Crescent Trail stuff. I'm also parenting more. I mean, those things, like, try having the money first and then tell me that it's not better to do that first. Like, try it. Like, maybe it's not better, but to be such a workaholic that you want to call out financial independence people and say, you know, you're just doing something, but that's kind of worthless or doesn't make sense. Okay, like, try it. Let's do an A/B test here, because most of the people I know who have done financial independence, yes, they go through kind of a little crisis mode where they're like, oh man, I don't know, you know, I have this gap in my life. But then on the other side of that, they're living really well. I mean, it's a pretty cool lifestyle. So, you know, but off my rant, off my little soapbox there. But yeah, I get a little frustrated by that feedback.
Does it? This is a great point, because, well, it's hard for people on the journey to have the pile of money and test it out. So do you have a recommendation for people that are like maybe midway or like more than 50%? And they're like, I kind of want to try it. I don't want to like quit cold turkey. Like you had a pretty dramatic situation where you had like a big exit, seven figure. Oh, like that's a lot. So what do you think, Chad? How could people like test this?
Yeah, where's my pile of money? Where do I get the pile of money?
That's we want the pile of money.
The growing pile. Like, let's use the pile of money metaphor, but it's kind of like a mountain. Like the mountain peak might be your FI number, but I like to look at it like, how many plateaus along the way do you want to hit where you take these little mini retirements?
Yeah.
And mini retirement could be anything. It could be like 2 weeks. It could be a month. But like, do a brainstorm of what is it I think I want to do when I'm not working? What are the activities I want to try? And then do those like every 2 or 3 years, every 5 years. That's been our kind of seasonal lifestyle that my wife and I have done. And it's been fun as a couple too, because I was the one into financial independence early on. My wife was like not into this at all. But one of the fun conversations she had when I was like, well, what would you do? Like, you're a teacher, you like teaching, but what if you didn't have to go to those BS meetings that you have to do as a university professor all the time? Like, do you like those meetings? She's like, no, I hate those meetings. And so we've kind of crafted this, like, all right, what would a ideal English or Spanish teacher look like? It'd be, well, I teach two classes. I do some one-on-one tutoring. I never go to any of those BS meetings. I don't have to deal with any university politics. Like, every year she has like university people asking her to come back and teach full time. She's like, no, thank you. And so that's kind of what it's like. You test it out and say, what do I want to do? And then try to test it, to go on a little, you know, take a fall off, take a sabbatical, do something different. And then if you hate it, you're like, go back to work. That's cool. You can always go back, you know?
We have a couple celebrities walking by heckling us. Oh, they're beautiful. Just come on. Just walk behind us. Just walk behind for the video.
This is podcasters left and right. Yeah. Here they are. All right.
Matt and Joel from How to Money. So we'll chat with them soon. Good What's to see up, you, brother.
Man? Good to see you guys. Amazing. Much love.
All right. How do we recover from that? Well, I have a question for you guys. A lot of times we do bring up asparagus. And I don't know if you listen to the show, but we talk about asparagus all the time, specifically how it makes your peas smell. And not everyone, we can get into the science of it all, considering you're into biology and everything. But we'll take it offline a little bit. But does your pea smell when you eat asparagus?
Oh, yeah, very, that's it. Every time, yeah.
All right. And you too?
100%, yes.
Okay. And from, you know, more of the science point of view, like, why do some people not smell the bad smell with asparagus?
Well, I think it's because the name comes from asparagine, which is an amino acid. And I think like one out of every 20 people process it differently. So I think for some people, their pee does not actually smell. Chad, if you heard different from your organic chemistry class, let me know.
Right,
but that's what I learned.
You remember the chain, what that amino acid looks like and how it folds and all that stuff.
I do not
remember your biology class.
I do not remember any of that.
I don't either.
I'm sure it was great.
It was a good class.
And Carl, you were just in Germany, and I've been told they have the white asparagus, so they hide it in the dark, and it doesn't get the chlorophyll, it doesn't get the color, but it's extremely girthy.
It's very big around. Carl, you said you had some of those asparagus stocks.
Actually, they did not have it there. It was out of season. But what I did have, I'll tell you one quick story. I have a friend over there, so he's like, let's go to a traditional German restaurant. So we went there, and the thing was in German. Everyone spoke German, so I'm just like pointing at the menu and grunting. So this thing shows up. It was some kind of like pork thing with what I thought was a big pile of mozzarella cheese on top. I can show you the picture. It looked just like that. So I'm like, oh, wow, cheese, this is great. I took a big forkful of it I don't know why I did this, and stuck it in my mouth. And it turned out it was like fresh horseradish. So I stick this thing in my mouth. I'm like, I think flames came out of my nose like a dragon on Game of Thrones.
Did you down your whole beer from there, your whole stein? You know?
I don't know. It was very traumatic. Luckily, it's short acting. It's quick acting, good. So I quickly recovered. But yeah, not a good move.
All right, Carl, do you have any other thoughts on the line of questioning we were in? I forgot what we were talking about.
No. Girthy white asparagus. That's the last thing I remember.
How can you forget?
It was like the size of your wrist, wasn't it?
It's huge. No, I just think this whole conversation is fascinating because all four of us are financially independent, yet we paid to come to this conference to do work. Like you could say we're doing work right now.
Right.
But it's work that makes us happy and gives us meaning.
And it's so, we have like complete autonomy. So it's like who we want to talk to and interview, which is just our friends.
Thank you.
We can do it whenever we want. And yeah, just the autonomy feels really good. And when you're a cog, you don't get to pick anything. You have to go to the fucking meetings and it's just it's a real drag.
I got a question for y'all because you talk about FI on your, I talk about financial independence on my show, but as I get into the nitty gritty of real estate, I'm curious if you've had this dialogue, if, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, it was pretty obvious to a lot of people, like the financial independence movement was like, it was obvious. It was like, yeah, this sucks. I want this. I've seen a lot of popular kind of pushback. I don't know what the narrative is, but it's like kind of going the other way. And why is this even interesting? Do y'all still see that it's a popular thing to get out of the corporate cog? I wonder if that's, seems like that would be kind of universal, but I'm wondering, you guys kind of have more of a pulse on this a little bit more. What's the movement of FI like right now?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think it has evolved, and maybe it's evolved because our money has evolved and we all probably have a great net worth because the stock market has done good. So I'm not sure about what you're saying, Chad, but what I have seen is people, I guess, letting loose on the purse strings and spending a little bit more money on experiences and maybe getting away from the extreme frugality like Jacob Lund Fisker, early retirement extreme, and even early iterations of Mr. Money Mustache. I'm living on $24,000 a year. It seems like people are moving away from that. And that's the main thing I've noticed.
Yeah. And I think I understand what you're saying, Chad. I think there's more of a drive for slow FI or coast FI where people like lift off the gas a little bit instead of like working so hard. Like 1500 days, like you were on a sprint, you got there early. And I think, you know, through your experience, people understand like, okay, if you get to a good spot, then you could kind of relax a little bit and maybe you could go part time and it's not too bad. And you have a little bit more freedom and people are not so obsessed. And then you could kind of gradually like get into the right mindset because like if all of a sudden you have, you know, tons of freedom and a shitload of money, then you could potentially make some bad decisions and get depressed. And actually we've interviewed enough people where some people do hit depression and they have to kind of go through the existential crisis and figure it out. So yeah, I think people are moving towards a gradual situation.
Kind of expanding the idea of FI, which I think has always been there, but maybe more popularly, it was kind of perceived as 5 years, you go all in, you save 75% of your money, then you're out, and then there's just no other way. Whereas what we're saying is there's like a lot of paths, and you can get halfway there and take a break and get coast FI. That's what's that's kind of cool. It's a good thing, right? There's a lot of more variety in the conversation.
What do you see, Jeremy?
I agree. I don't see the ultimate frugality being as popular anymore, where it's like you can live on a farm and spend $10,000 a year. I think a book I'm hearing a ton about lately is Die with Zero, which is the idea that there's this time value to money where it's like if you have an exponential chart and you have $1 billion when you're 90 and then you croak, then you've wasted all of your money because you didn't get to use it. And, you know, every day, week, year, decade of your life is like the youngest remaining time of your life. And so the money you spend now is more valuable than the money you're going to spend when you're 80, because people who are 80 often don't travel as much or have medical issues or can't or already died or whatever. And so I think there is kind of a pendulum. Some people are not enough frugal and they get into crippling debt and they have to work forever and they are broke when they're old, which is bad. But I think some people go too far the other extreme and they say, I'm going to just save, save, save. And it's a numbers game that I'm going to win and then I'm going to die with the most. And I think they're also losing. So, you know, I hate to use the word balance, but you kind of want to use that money when you, you know, when the opportunity arises. And so, like, you know, we're in our 40s or we're just recently in our 40s and, you know, we're still kind of in peak physical condition, but that might not be the case in 20 or 30 years. And so maybe we shouldn't be trying to maximize value then. We should try or maximize monetary value then. We should be maximizing like utility value now.
Yeah, the whole point of financial independence is to have money to increase your joy and happiness. So if happiness and joy is the end goal, it should be the goal all the time. Why postpone that? Do a sprint to just to accumulate a bunch of money. I think you have to find a way to reconcile your life with your goal of financial independence. For example, like I didn't like my job. I should have just got, but it paid a lot, so I stayed there. I should have just made peace with quitting my job, done something I enjoyed more, maybe worked there another year or two longer, and then I would have had a better time with life and more joy.
Yeah. Very good. Okay. Anything else in this realm, or should we shift gears a little bit?
All right.
So selfishly, I've been looking at e-bikes a little bit. So I talked to Pete, Mr. Money Mustache, and he gets so fucking excited about bikes and riding bikes. And I was like, all right, like I've looked before and I'm kind of interested. He gave me some tips on some brands that he's interested in. But I think you guys have a little experience with e-bikes. So I'll send it to you first, Jeremy, maybe.
Yeah.
And then to Chad. Yeah.
Recently I bought an e-bike for my fiance for her birthday. And I dove into the world and doing all the research, like the classes and the pedal tension and the brakes and the, you know, and I guess I kind of did land on frugality a little bit, because you could go crazy. And I ended up going with Lectric brand, which is kind of like a cheaper brand, but still like has a lot of good, you know, good features or whatever. I was like, you know, let's start here. If we hate e-biking, then we didn't waste a lot of money. It's really fun. You know, the charge lasts a long time. You go fast. It definitely makes you more likely to want to go biking. You can zip around town. We got the utility bike where you can pile the kids in the back, get groceries, whatever. It's really been a good success. And it's under $2,000 for ours.
Okay. And it's like I've looked at some of those too. So it's like the XP3, but it's like the more utility, like, so you can put more stuff on there.
Right. I think it's got the big bag. I think it's called the Electric Expedition. This is not a plug. I don't know this company, but yeah. And then it comes with like a little, called the Orbiter, like a little ring around this. It's like a big luggage rack on the back, essentially. But then you can plop the kids in there. And my fiance has a 3-year-old and he loves it because he can just sit in there and hold on and like feels very free. It's much faster to throw them on there than even put them into a car seat or something. And so if we're just like going a mile to pick up food or something, it's like a really fun way to do it.
Okay, cool. All right. What about you, Chad?
So I've been using an e-bike for 5 or 6 years, but it's broken. So I'm in the market for another one and I want to fix that one. But I'll tell you what we had on that. And I'm not very technical in my research of this stuff, but I had a friend who was a local bike dealer, or I had a bike shop, and it was called a Turn, T-E-R-N. And it was actually one of these that at the time we had just had a Toyota car. And so we could fold the e-bike up and you could put it in your trunk. That was like a big deal for us. But it's kind of undersized for me. So I'm 6'3". And we bought a bike that was like, it's kind of like a futon bed. It's not a good couch. It's not a good bed, but it's like in between. It can do both. Like this was not my wife. The bike did not fit my wife's size. It didn't fit me. It was in between, and neither one of us like really fit it very well.
Okay.
So like, it's like me, a big man on this little bike, you know, kind of biking, but I used it all the time. Like I fell in love with e-bikes because I've talked about my bike infrastructure is not very good in Clemson, but I can get it anywhere in town, in the small town, in 10 minutes on my e-bike.
Yeah.
And it's in the summer, it's hot. And so if anybody wanted to meet with me, have coffee, whatever, if I wanted to go look at one of my rental properties, I would use my e-bike and I would just take off. And it was amazing. And since the battery went dead, so I'm going to have to replace the battery. But it's I've been kind of, you know, it's been not as far. Like, I really miss it, not being able to use it. So I want to buy a new one that fits me, and I want to get that one fixed. And then my wife and I will both have a bike, and we can ride around, ride more.
Okay. And then, Carl, you have an e-bike. Tell us about yours.
So I do. I built my own, and this was way back in 2017. The reason I built my own was because there weren't many e-bikes available at the time, and they were all very expensive, so there weren't many choices. Also, I wanted one that would go very fast. I used to ride motorcycles, so my e-bike, I can go like 40 miles an hour without any pedal input. So it feels like a motorcycle.
I've ridden
like
it one time.
Motorcycle. Yeah.
I remember visiting you and riding that down the street. It was pretty nuts.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I wouldn't recommend building your own now, though. There's so many good choices, and they've come way down in price. So I would definitely get an off-the-shelf one. But I'm kind of curious, Doug, what is your use case for an e-bike?
I think... Yeah, that's a great question. I think I would go to the grocery store occasionally. So actual like replacement for my old truck. And there's some greenways, so I'm not comfortable riding on the streets very much. But there's some greenways, so it would be very minimal if I have to get on the street. And maybe some, you know, just other stuff around Longmont. So a lot of stuff is pretty close. Like I could ride to HQ pretty easily. I rode my actual bike, non-e-bike, in the past. And maybe some leisure, but I'm not a mountain biker, and I have low interest. I may want to get on gravel occasionally, but nothing technical.
Sure.
Does that help? Do you have any recommendations? Or?
Yeah, I might get one of those cargo bikes, maybe something like what Jeremy alluded to, or a rad wagon where they've got stuff to put things on back. And I will say, I know you don't like being on streets, but... I actually feel safer being on an e-bike on the street because you're going more with the pace of a car. And if there's a bad situation, it might be easier to get out of it because you've got the speed and power. You're not going super slow.
But, if your e-bike goes 40, which I don't think is even legal, don't they cap it at 28 or something?
They do, unless you build your own. Some of them you can hack. You could put a cable in there and hack it. So yeah, 28 is the maximum speed, but that's only for off-road ones. 20 is supposed to be the street speed limit.
Got it. Okay. Yeah, and I think I'll probably, you know, we're approaching Black Friday deals are going to be around. And yeah, like the Electric, and there's a couple other direct-to-consumer brands, which are about half the price of what I was looking at like some of the shops, because I was like, oh, fuck, this is like $2,000 plus. And then, I don't know, they price them so that like all of a sudden you're like, all right, I'm at $3,600 then. Like, yeah, exactly. What happened? They seem pretty cool, and everybody seems to like them. So strong chance I'll get one before too long. All right. Cool. Carl, do you have any other big questions?
Ooh, I don't think so. I see you passed on your Chevy Volt. We were talking about that a couple weeks ago, but you decided not to get your new car, which seems like a good decision. You don't really drive that much.
Yeah, I don't drive too much. Yeah, one of my neighbors was getting rid of his Chevy Volt. It was a 2018. Are you guys familiar with this car?
I know it's an electric car.
So it's a plug-in hybrid, and I think when you run off the gas engine, it's like 45 miles to gallon, so it's pretty decent. I have an old like V8 truck currently, so not great on gas mileage, but I hardly drive at all. Like I can walk to the gym, like the store is super close, so I hardly drive.
It's pretty amazing, by the way, that you can live in a place to do that.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah, there's tons of restaurants I could walk to, and yeah, it's good. The thing with the Volt, I just wasn't excited about the Volt overall, even though it seems like a good option for a lot of people. So, but ultimately, I was like, I'll just keep the truck for a little while. I'll keep someone else from driving the truck, basically, because I could sell it. I could resell it for pretty decent, I think.
I was going to say, you're truck nuts. I know you would probably take them off your truck and put them on the Volt or your e-bike, your Volt. But that would look kind of weird, like truck
nuts.
They'd
be dragging.
Yeah, truck nuts. Especially yours are pretty big. They'd definitely be out of place on either of those electric vehicles.
They're huge, yeah.
Bigger than the Asperges?
Much bigger.
Very good.
Okay, good.
What kind of cars do y'all drive, if you don't mind me asking?
I drove used cars my whole life. Yeah, 99 Ford Explorer was a car I was driving when I sold my company. I finally bought a new car as a millionaire. I bought a Mazda. And then most recently, I drove the Mazda for 6 years, and most recently I bought a Tesla, so I have a Model 3.
Nice.
I love the electric cars. I don't think I'll get another Tesla, but I don't think I can ever drive a gas car again. Like, I love waking up with a full battery, I love this, how it's silent. You hit the gas, it goes like so fast. It's so easy. It's like all techie. I'm all about electric cars.
Which year Model 3 is it?
2023.
Okay, cool.
I'm a Toyota super fan. I like Toyotas. My first car in high school was a Toyota Camry, and it lasted forever. So I drive a Toyota RAV4. We bought it used. My wife inherited a car. Her mom's, when she passed away, had a Lexus. And so we would not buy a Lexus normally, but it's like an old Lexus. And so we're in the Toyota family. I used to drive an Avalon as well. So
nice.
A Tesla is enticing to me. One of these days, I would like to have an electric car. But it's just
amazing.
It's not a kind of my top of my priority list at the moment. Yeah. So one of these days, e-bike is higher on my list than the electric car.
Much cheaper too.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you like the Y so far?
Yeah. So I have a Tesla Model Y, and the main reason I bought that was because I bought Tesla stock a long time ago, and Elon Musk has bet the company on FSD efforts, and that is their efforts to make the cars autonomous and to create autonomous driving fleets. So as a shareholder, I thought I should keep track of their autonomous efforts. So I bought the Y. Signed up for the FSD package, and it's only tried to kill us a couple times. It did a weird move on the way to the airport. Your friend with the dog, the car, like kind of freaked out a little bit when it saw that.
Oh, yeah. It does weird things sometimes, but it didn't kill anyone.
Do you use it a lot? Do you like I have it too, but I find myself rarely using it not on a freeway.
Yes, I use it every chance I get just so I can try to detect improvement in it, and I don't know. It's much better than it was a year ago, but it's still a long way to go if they're going to have driverless operation with the vehicles.
What year is yours?
2023 as well.
Okay. Yeah, I think that 23s and later are on like the newer hardware, which is supposed to be better for that, but I agree. It's not. Doesn't feel like it's quite there yet. I'm still a little bit nervous about it, I guess.
I have to say, I'm always impressed with Carl, but I'm impressed with his deep research of stocks. Like he'll buy the Tesla to research it as a customer. And I was thinking about the logic of this. Okay, so let's say it doesn't work and he almost kills his family. And then he can sell his Tesla stock at his high, and then he can short it. Yeah. And I mean, he's always going to make money on stocks.
Exactly.
This guy is like a pretty brilliant stock investor.
The first call is to his broker, and the second call is 911.
Yeah, exactly.
So what about Elon's politics, though?
No, I'm just kidding.
No.
Just kidding. We're not going to talk about that. All right.
Very good. Very good. Okay. Let's start winding down a little bit. And I want to talk about Nectarine a little bit. So, Jeremy, this is your newest startup. And I've been recommending people to check it out because there's a lot of use cases where I think it does work. And my wife and I, she recently retired like 6 months ago.
Nice.
And really the only way that she would have retired is if we hire an advisor and like get some expert input, even though like we're engineers, we're spreadsheet people. Like we see where we're at, but we needed some help. So what's Nectarine all about?
Well, I've been doing personal finance education for the last 6 years now. And I'd always get the question, how do I find a good financial advisor? The exact, the situation that you and your wife were in. And if you would ask me that, and said, where do I go? A few years ago, I would have said, oh, it's tough because the world of financial advisors is weird. Most of them, they make money by selling specific products. And so if you went to this type of financial advisor to say, hey, can I retire? They would think, how do I sell them my products, right? It's like, so it's such a conflict of interest. Then the other type of financial advisor is an assets under management advisor where they charge you like a percent of your assets. And again, you could say, hey, can I retire? And their whole incentive model is give me all of your money, I'll manage it for you, and then I will give you advice like you asked to answer your question, only insofar as I don't lose you as a client, right? And so it's like these weird conflicts. And so when people would ask, how do I find a good financial advisor, I'd basically say, yeah, don't do those. Find someone who charges by the hour or by the project where you can just ask them your questions without those weird commission or AUM incentives. And they would always ask me, they'd say, great, how do I find one of those? And my answer would be, I have no idea. They're hard to find. They're just disjointed. And so that's why we built Nectarine. It's an advice-only financial advice marketplace where you can find a financial advisor. You can see their availability, see their reviews, see their prices, book directly online. And then within an hour or two, you can be on a Zoom call asking your questions with a fiduciary CFP who has no incentive other than to help you. And I think when people the world of financial advice, I don't know, my feeling is like when you talk to a financial advisor, it's like, oh, what are they trying to sell me, or what's their angle? Or like, it's just like this weird thing. But when you talk to one that doesn't have an angle other than helping you, it's like this really like different clarifying experience. And so, I mean, for, you know, you and your wife, you could go talk to a Nectarine fiduciary by the hour and then have no worry about them just trying to sell you something.
And one thing which you didn't mention, but one thing I like about Nectarine is you can also filter by their specialty. So if I'm looking for, I don't actually know if this is one of them, but like senior retirement planning, I can put that as a filter and find someone who is has direct knowledge of what I'm trying to seek advice for.
Exactly. You can filter by their specialty, what you're looking for, even your demographic, like if you're military or healthcare workers, whatever it is, because each kind of demographic might have different situations. Then you can see just those advisors. You can see their reviews, see when they're available. We're just kind of trying to add a lot of transparency rather than be just like a yellow pages of phone numbers that you can call and get a, you know, free consultation or something.
What's the yellow pages?
Exactly. We're still catching up with some old tech.
I used to advertise in the yellow pages. That dates me as well. Yeah. Sorry for derailing the conversation there.
Oh, good.
No. Nectarine is super cool. I think I've recommended it to three people. Most recently was someone who went to a bank and the bank tried to sell them an annuity. And yeah, they were very convinced that they should buy this thing because the person working at the bank was very, very nice. I'm like, well, and I don't think they trust in my opinion. I'm like, well, let's find someone at Nectarine to talk to and review our situation. So I'm actually going to do that next month.
It's wild how the advice changes when the incentives change. Like if you walk into a life insurance salesman office and ask them for financial advice, I can virtually guarantee you the advice is going to be buy life insurance. But when someone is not selling life insurance and is just a fiduciary there to help you with no financial incentive, they can talk to you about life insurance. They say, hey, you actually might need some life insurance because you have young children, you don't have net worth. Or they might say, you don't need life insurance at all. You're 25 and you're healthy and you don't have kids and you are building wealth. You'd actually be better putting your money elsewhere, right? And so, yeah, like when you walk into a bank, their job is to sell you banking products, right? And so it really is remarkable how, you know, there's that famous quote that says, it's very hard to get a man to understand something when his living depends on not understanding it. And so people who sell a product for a living aren't going to give you kind of unbiased advice for your situation. They're going to try to sell you the product.
Who's like the ideal client or person to try? Because I know when we went to an advisor, there were a few meetings. Like we probably needed about 3 to 5 hours to get a baseline and then a projection. So it was a bit of a, I don't know, kind of a package. So like what should people expect if they're like, hey, I want to get a little advice? Like, should they expect to have to meet a few times?
It depends. We actually currently have like two different options. One is called the hour, where you just pick a time, meet on Zoom, you have an hour, and then you get a write-up afterwards with like notes and to-do items. And that works really good for things like a second opinion on your current advisor, or am I doing my 401k right? Help me with a rollover, portfolio review, kind of things that don't require a deep dive. If you're asking, I'm 5 years out, can I retire? That's not going to happen in an hour. So we have another option called the plan, where it's like an 8-week process that has multiple meetings, like full review of all your documents and tax returns and financials and all that stuff. And then that's more of like a complete plan. So we're trying to, a lot of people just need an expert to look at their screen and bounce some ideas off of, and an hour is perfect. And some people need a more in-depth thing. You know, you kind of asked about our ideal, you know, customers. I'd say, you know, certainly DIY investors, people who don't already have an asset manager, are the ones that want someone to go to without the weird incentives. But I think more people are shifting to that, right? Your average, you know, 50-year-old, no offense, Carl, maybe has grew up in, I mean, I'm almost 52, so I can't really talk, but grew up in a world where that's how you invested. Your family has a guy, you give him your money, he sends you reports every once in a while, and you don't really understand how he gets paid. It's very murky, but, you know, and maybe he's very nice, you know, no offense to that guy. But, you know, your average 25-year-old isn't doing that. Your average 25-year-old is opening up Robinhood or, you know, M1 or what, you know, or Fidelity or Vanguard or whatever, doing it themselves, and is kind of suspicious of that old model. So I think as the world shifts more towards DIY investing, because it's never been easier to access low cost discount brokerages, I think there's this advice only financial advisor is going to be a bigger need.
Jeremy, I'm new to the fee only kind of world, but is it typical that somebody has that first meeting and then almost like, you know, I have a CPA I use every year, I have a family attorney who helps. I mean, I would assume like it makes sense to have a relationship with a fee-only financial planner over time, or is that not typical even with this crowd?
For sure. You know, I think it depends on your situation, right? Some people meet once and they're like, great, that's all I need. And some people come back 6 months later. Some people have three or four meetings right up front. You know, it really depends. You know, CPAs have the natural advantage of you have to file taxes every year. So like you kind of have to meet them with them every year. It's kind of like having a CPA without that, you know, tax deadline every year, because you just kind of meet as you need.
Yeah.
Cool. So we're affiliates for Nectarine. So we'll link up and we get a commission if you sign up and all that. But if it's what you're looking for, it's kind of the perfect solution that kind of didn't exist before. So thanks for setting it up. And if people want to learn more, we'll put a link and you just check it out. So
awesome. Thank you.
Chad, what are you working on? What's going on with you?
Yeah, I'm full in on coaching and teaching. That's kind of my world right now. And so we talked about going back into work again. And I was sitting in Spain and we were chilling out, drinking sangria and cerveza. And I was like, you know, I'm kind of halfway in. Like I make a podcast. I do this. It's fun. But it was more of a like professional hobby, which is cool. Like I think that's cool too. But then I also noticed all my expenses in this thing were going up and I was getting a little bit of success on YouTube. And I was like I couldn't catch up with my email inbox. And I'm like, I was in this weird in-between space where I said, I either need to be like a full-time teacher or I need to like really step back from this thing. And I decided that I wanted to do more teaching, more coaching. So I'm doing that. That's what I spend like most of my time. I spend a couple hours a week on real estate investing, kind of managing my managers on my properties. And then I do YouTube videos. I have a new podcast every Monday. I call it the Small and Mighty Real Estate Investor. So that's my audience, people who are, you know, not trying to scale to the moon and have 1,000 units. They're, you know, 5 units, 10 units, 20 units. They're just having enough so they have cash flow and ability to do what they want to do. And so I try to teach them how to do that, teach them how do you acquire the property, how do you finance it well, how do you manage it once you have it, how do you build systems and teams. And so it's like a little business. You know, real estate, unlike, you know, index fund investing, is you don't really need to understand the businesses you own with index fund. You do need to understand property management, and you need to understand maintenance and how to use spreadsheets. And it's not rocket science, but I have a lot of fun teaching that. And it's taken me full circle back to my sports days of the football, because I feel like I'm kind of channeling. I don't coach sports except for my kids, but I really like the idea of that your success is other people's success, that if other people make money, they build wealth, then you have the satisfaction of that. And it's like 10 times more satisfying than when I was doing it myself. And I think that's, I feel pretty lucky to be able to do that on a day-to-day basis.
And you just got your 100K plaque, is that right, on YouTube?
Yeah, 100,000 subscribers.
Congrats.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
That's
cool.
Nice.
So,
that's the first one. That's your first. Yeah. That's so cool. I'm so jealous of that.
My kids think I'm the coolest guy in the world now, because apparently everybody in elementary and middle school wants to be a YouTuber now. So if your dad is a YouTuber, my daughter was going around the school as I got to 99,000 saying, you need to subscribe to my dad's channel. It's really boring, but you please subscribe, you know. So that's my 11-year-old, you know, lover. But
realistic business or a more realistic career path than it used to be. I feel like you could. It's like actually like maybe someone can go into that as a job and have a pretty high likelihood of success.
They want to do YouTube. So I've kind of gotten them into editing videos a little bit and saying, if you're interested in this, like let's build skills. Let's not just be famous. Like let's try to like actually have skills of editing and let's practice making your own videos. One of my daughters went to a video camp this summer on making like film. But like the idea was you can make your own shorts and storytelling. So I think it's there's some cool side of it. There's also like the dark side of the internet and kids getting on the internet, but it's fun. It's kind of fun to connect with our kids. I didn't think YouTube would be that like connection, but real estate, boring, YouTube, awesome. That's my feed from them.
Yeah, Chad is great. I saw you speak at BPCon and I love your message because I think it flies in the face of most real estate investors, or a lot of them. Like I'll talk to, I was just at BPCon, and a lot of people have this ridiculous goal of X number of doors. Like I want 1,000 doors, or I heard someone saying they want a portfolio in the billions with a B. And you aren't like that. I feel that your goal is to live a rich life. Real estate is one means to do that, but you don't need to go crazy. Get as much as you need and then don't go for any more. And I also like you because I think there's some suspicious characters in the real estate world, maybe around syndications. And I know that you would never compromise yourself or lead someone astray. If there was anyone who wanted to become a real estate investor, you would be by far the number one person I would direct them to, because I know you're not going to lead someone astray just to make yet another dollar or get another door under your belt.
That's another incentive conversation, right? Like how do you Why are they doing that? What motivates them? You always should ask that question. That's a really good question. But I feel like my message, my movement that I'm trying to build is like the foil of the 10X, go big. You know, you are not successful unless you've gone big. I'll name names. It's like the Grant Cardones of the world. If Grant Cardone wants to debate me on a podcast, I would say, bring it on, buddy. Let's go.
He's going to hear this.
Is he going
to
be here?
To the show.
Let's go, yeah. Grant. Let's do this.
Right, the 401k is a scam, right? I think that's what he told me.
Yeah, home ownership's a scam as well. But anyway, I mean, cool. We can disagree on stuff. But the thing that I think is dangerous is like people like they borrow goals from others. Like they see people as heroes. They look up to them and they kind of just do it because that's what another person did instead of saying. So I'm trying to like give not just me like other examples. And I feel like the FI community, that's really what is awesome about it. Is like there are people who have enough. There are people who are good parents. They're good, you know, they're doing other things. They're starting new businesses. And you can look at that and say they're into life and being the best person they can be. And then they're using money and real estate and these things as a tool to get there. That's a very different message than you're not a good person unless you keep going. You're small, literally, you're a small person if you're not playing big. And I think that's kind of silly. And it's, you know, just want to share an alternative viewpoint on that.
Where can people find you?
Coach Carson, if you search on YouTube, if you search on online Google, I don't do much on social media, but I do have some Instagram channels and things like that. But YouTube is the main spot.
Cool.
And then you go to my website.
All right. We'll link up to that stuff. Thanks, Chad. Thanks, Jeremy. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carl. Thanks for sitting in today.
Thanks, Doug. Right. Good to be back.
All right. Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week.